Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today's cool fact of the day is that the Industrial Revolution changed more than 10,000 years of human grain consumption. In the 1870s, we invented the modern steel roller mill, which completely changed how we milled grain. Compared to the old stone methods, it was really fast and efficient. And it gave you really fine control over different parts of the kernel. So instead of just mashing it all together, you could separate the parts, allowing the purest and finest of white flour to come out at a very low cost. And that meant that people with almost the very lowest levels of income could still afford the fancy flour. And the good thing about white flour is, well, it ships better, stores better, allows for a long distribution chain. In fact, you could keep it almost forever because it seems like nothing wants to eat it except for humans. And we now know that it's because it was stripped of nutrients and pest problems were less of an issue because, well, bugs and rodents didn't want to eat it. The problem was that, well, grains, even if they're not treated that way, are not particularly good for humans because before the Industrial Revolution, we had the Agricultural Revolution, which is when humans dropped a foot in height in some places, and we started getting cavities and other degenerative diseases we didn't have before. And there's really good science to help explain why that happened. And so, yeah, pizza and croissants taste good. Doesn't mean you need to make them out of grains. There are other ways to do it. And if you want to continue eating those things, well, to put it really bluntly, you'll probably die sooner from something painful than if you choose not to do that. And you'll probably not like the quality of your life as much as you would if you made better choices. I wish it wasn't so. However, that's what the science that I'm aware of says, both from my own extensive research and self-experimenting, and from having the opportunity to interview some of the world's smartest and best and most impactful people out there on Bulletproof Radio.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com.
And I'm really pleased to have a dear friend, just a fantastic human being, a guy with a crazy amount of education and experience across different fields of medicine, a famous author, and someone who I featured in Game Changers on the show again. I'm talking about none other than Dr. David Perlmutter, author of Grain Brain. I think you're also the author of four other New York Times bestsellers and a practicing neurologist and... well, just an overall fantastic guy. David, welcome to the show, man. That's the best I could do for you, but it still wasn't adequate.
Oh, my gosh. It's an honor. And, you know, your listeners need to know that right back at you. We both do podcasts. We both interview a lot of people. But, you know, you and I have had the great fortune of taking it a step further and spending some really quality time together, family time together, and it really has been very, very meaningful for us. That's for sure.
Well, it's inspiring for me, and I'm going way off what I was planning to talk about. But when I first got going on Bulletproof and Bulletproof Radio and all, you see these authors kind of up in the clouds. You know, they write these books and you read these books and you're sort of like, what kind of people are they? Right. And then eventually with the work that I'm doing, I got a chance to meet you. And, you know, there are a lot of people who don't have to write books, and they write books because they've studied this for many years and because they think it matters. And they just go around generally doing good work and helping people with an attitude that's amazing. You're one of the probably the most giving guys I've met. Just every time I've seen you interact with someone, whoever they are, you're just like, how can I help? So that's something that's hard to see if you read your books or if, you know, just look at you from afar. But just having gotten to know you, this is a hallmark of people who succeed really well. And it's one of the things that came out from looking at what 500 people do. It's the people who learn how to be happy tend to be more successful. And everything I know about you says that you figured out how to do that and that's powered some of what you do. True statement?
Yeah. I mean, I am eternally grateful every moment of my life for just the life that I've had the opportunity to live so far. I mean, the family that I have been gifted, the people I've gotten to know. Maybe it's, you know, rose-colored glasses. I see things as being just extremely positive. I am a realist. I see what's going on around us. But, you know, I have complete faith in us as a species and in our ability to do the right things and move things in the right direction despite temporary setbacks. And I think it is more along the lines of being an investor and not a trader. You know, I'm looking at where we're going in the long run, and I think the slope is exactly where we need it to be. Are there setbacks along the way? You bet there are. But this is looking at the climate as opposed to looking at the day-to-day weather. And we know, and that's not necessarily a positive thing or not necessarily the best metaphor, but it, again, just speaks to the long view that I take in a very positive way. And I've always said that today is the best day of my life. The reason being is that it builds on yesterday. And yesterday until today was the best day of my life. And the good things are cumulative. The bad things do not enter into that equation. So therefore, today has to be the best day of your life. If one tiny thing was good that happened, then it moves the ball a little bit further. So that's the attitude I take. Well,
it shows. And part of the reason that I put all the, it's about 8,000 hours into Game Changers was to understand, you know, that the mindset is one of the many things that that people who've had a big impact do. And when I say you've had a big impact, you've won the Linus Pauling Award for treating neurological disorders in a new way. I mean, you've spoken at the World Bank. You're now an author as a top expert in the field of the emerging science of microbiome and the brain, and just kind of this amazing list of accomplishments throughout your career in diverse fields, which are profound. And one of them is your book, Grain Brain, really helped people see that it's not just a bunch of cavemen or hippies saying don't eat grain. And I have no problem with cavemen or hippies or cavemen hippies for that matter. But if you want to get people who, you know, aren't doing lots of research to make a change, well, here I'm a highly credentialed neurologist and here's the hard science and it's accessible. So Grain Brain really helped to change the conversation to make it normal to go to a restaurant and say don't put gluten in that, and they actually know what gluten is. But you just rewrote the entire book 5 years after it came out. From the ground
we
up.
We did. We really did. And it was as much effort as went into the first book. But I will tell you, with this time around, there was so much enthusiasm in the project, I think, that was engendered because of the degree and level of science that has come in the past 5 years that has been so supportive and validating of our original a very much disruptive contention. So, you know, we were talking about gluten and sugar and carbohydrates as being toxins with reference to the brain at a time This was long ago. This is ancient history, 5 years ago, when there was plenty of pushback, though the science at that time was burgeoning. The original book was written based mostly, to significant degree, what brought it about, at least, was clinical experience in dealing with patients, then finding the support of science. But as you well know, in the past 5 years, the science surrounding lower carbohydrate, dare I say, even to the extent of ketogenesis, as well as the more recent science on gluten and non-celiac gluten sensitivity, we'll talk about that, has really been so extensive, so validating. And so it's great to have now gotten so much support. And this book, Grain Brain, has been translated into 34 languages around the world. It was, I saw one of my books this morning. Somebody sent me an Instagram picture of it on a TV show in Turkey. And it's just, these are people I will never see, never personally experience as a clinician. But yet to think that somebody on the other side of the world is going to get a simple message. And that is that, hey, this aberrant diet that we feel is appropriate for humans, a diet quite unlike anything we've experienced in 99.6% of our time walking this planet, that we really need to consider that this is a threat directly in terms of the provision of macronutrients like carbohydrates, directly threatening to our health, and also secondarily threatening to our health in that this is a diet that's sending really bad signals to our genome, which then expresses genes that enhance inflammation, that degrade our antioxidant quenching ability, that compromise our ability to detoxify the very toxins that are now part of our environment when we desperately need to amp up our detoxification system. So I think the one research project I think that really I leverage the most in terms of validating these recommendations is a study that's been going on for 2 million years. It is called the human being. And it's demonstrated that you bet a diet lower in carbs, higher in healthful fat, a diet that gives us lots of good nutrient fiber, has kept us going for 2 million years. And suddenly, what did we learn in the past few days? We learned that for the first time, at least in recent history, that life expectancy for men and women in the United States has not only plateaued, but has now begun to decline. We haven't changed genetically. We certainly have changed the epigenetic signaling that we are now engaged with. So now more than ever, I think we've got this robust data that says, suddenly take a deep breath. What has changed and what can we do to make it right?
It's interesting that you talk about carbohydrates because in Game Changers, where I summarize all this knowledge, one of the 46 laws of high performance is feed the little bastards in your gut. And you're one of several experts I cite in that. Like, this is what the people who are performing really well actually do. And I wrote the law. It says the bacteria in your gut control a lot more than you might imagine. They have the power to make you fat, tired, and slow, to give you extra energy to tap into new power, or even to make you depressed. They're in the driver's seat, and if you treat them poorly, your performance will suffer. When you treat them well, they serve you. Learn how to make them do your bidding. But they eat, at least primarily, carbohydrates in the form of fiber.
Correct.
Because fiber is a carb. And I'm a little concerned. I've even experimented with something very close to the carnivore diet, where people are eating only meat, or you get what I would like to call the keto bros, where, well, if it's not a carb, I'll just eat it. So I'm having pork rinds, bacon, and that's it for the rest of my life. And is there some carbohydrate confusion?
Oh, without a doubt.
Walk me through that.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. And I think that I'd like your listeners to really tune in, because I think I don't know where we're going later in our time together, but this is very important.
Yeah.
And indeed, it is carbohydrate confusion, because we desperately, desperately need carbs. So many people adopt a ketogenic program and totally abandon their carbohydrate intake. Yeah. And what happens? They feel crappy. They become constipated. They get brain fog. They don't sleep well. They're agitated. And it's all because they fail to understand that we have to be quite specific when we talk about carbohydrates, that we are desperately in need of fiber in the diet, which is by definition a complex carbohydrate that we don't metabolize but is yet metabolized by our gut bacteria. When we throw that baby out with the bathwater, we set the stage for not nurturing what you mentioned, these 100 billion organisms that live within us that really depend on your food choices, 100 trillion, depend on your food choices to nurture them, to allow you to not just be healthy, but be healthier, to be able to combat risk of illness moving forward. In other words, preventive programs. So if you want to make it more simple, then perhaps if you talk about the notion of net carbohydrates, which is fiber minus these simple carbohydrates and minus sugar alcohols, for example. So we want to understand that we do need fiber. We've eaten fiber, and in fact, looking back at our ancestors, they ate a heck of a lot of fiber, as much as 100 to 120 grams of fiber a day, and had many bowel movements a day and nurtured their gut bacteria. So it's a huge mistake. And if that helps to unwind or unpack this notion of carbohydrate confusion, I'm really happy, because, again, we want people to eat a lot of good fat, a lot of good fiber, not a lot of protein. You know, in fact, this recommendation that we're making is absolutely not an Atkins redux. We don't want you sucking down pork rinds and meat mm-hmm. all day long. I mean, the China study, Dr. Campbell, you know, drew a correlation between red meat consumption and risk for colorectal cancer. And as a matter of fact, does Dr. Perlmutter agree with that? You bet I do. Why? Because first of all, there are some downsides of taking in too much protein with reference to certain biochemical pathways, activation of mTOR, for example, ultimately leading to—
You're talking about too much cysteine, too much methionine, the amino acids that come from eating too much protein?
Exactly right.
Cause aging, basically, right?
Correct. And turn on cell signaling pathways that are disruptive. But beyond that, the data that is utilized for these studies involves dietary analysis with a question on the dietary questionnaire asking simply, how often do you eat red meat? How much red meat do you eat? So that they're ultimately able to categorize people into eating high amounts of red meat versus low. Now, red meat, by and large, is one of the most dangerous foods on the planet. And by that, I mean the factory farmed red meat that typifies the type of red meat that people generally consume. If you're consuming a food that comes from an animal that's been antibiotic exposed, that's been fed glyphosate-rich grains and has been stressed throughout its existence, there's no alchemy that occurs here. You're going to create a food product that is absolutely threatening to your health. On the other hand, if you choose to be omnivorous and choose to eat some red meat on occasion, then it must be grass-fed beef or other type of meat, really emulating how these animals did live prior to this industrialization of our food supply. So by and large, though, I would indicate that the more plant-based is your diet, the better off you will be. If you choose to have a garnish of red meat, then it should fulfill the criteria I just proposed. Wild fish as well, some free-range chicken. Eggs, I think, are a really handy food and
don't sound plant-based, though.
Like, no, they're not. Kinda, I'm just saying.
It scares me when people say the more plant-based you are, because that drives you to become a vegan. And I can tell you, I know very few long-term vegans who are even average health. I mean, it's exceptionally rare. I mean, so that was that a plug for veganism?
No, not at all. I said by and large, the diet should be plant-based.
Mostly plants, but it doesn't mean all plant-based. It's that nuance where I think people get stuck.
Absolutely.
And by the way, I'm in alignment with you here. If I think red meat it can be great for you. You eat a couple ounces of it. You never eat industrial meat. It never has antibiotics in it. And if you do that and you take care of your gut bacteria, you don't have the gut bacteria that make TMAO,
right,
which is a compound that causes all of the risk factors, at least most of them, I would say, from these studies of red meat. And I've had my gut bacteria tested. Guess what? I don't have anything that makes TMAO because I don't eat antibiotic tainted meat. So there's nuances. There's also what kind of cut. Are you doing collagen from red meat, which has a different effect because it doesn't have all these amino acids? So it's such a complex thing, but I just want to make sure that unless you were meaning to do it, that people didn't say, oh, if mostly plant-based is good, therefore only plant-based is better. That hasn't been my experience.
I am so glad that you're holding my feet to the fire on this, because we don't want people to get the wrong idea. I would agree with you that by and large, without certain important caveats, that people, vegans can get into trouble with low levels of certain things, vitamin D, vitamin B12, even not getting adequate levels of dietary fat.
Yeah.
Who knew? I mean, who knew this was going to be an area of actual importance? And that said, overdoing the meat side of this equation at multiple levels, not just the antibiotics, but as you well mentioned, the conversion of TMA into TMAO when a diet is rich in choline and carnitine. We see even higher levels of trimethylamine oxide, TMAO, even in the spinal fluid. So this becomes not just a cardiovascular event, increasing inflammatory changes within the coronary arteries, but it becomes an event with reference to the brain as well. So, there are multiple levels upon which we can discuss these dietary nuances directly in terms of the macronutrients and micronutrients. But the second order, which really I think should probably be the first order, would be how these things are viewed through the lens of the gut organisms. And there are so many things to consider. I mean, I mentioned detoxification earlier, that, our front line of detox is the detox that happens as one of the tasks that our gut bacteria lovingly do for us day in and day out, which we certainly need these days in our very toxic world. We know that these gut bacteria are producing various metabolic products, the short chain fatty acids that have effects throughout the body, and even vitamins, some of the B vitamins. We're learning, from my perspective as a brain specialist, that the gut bacteria actually are playing a role in the production of this really important chemical called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. We'll probably touch on that later, but important for making connections in your brain. We call that neuroplasticity, for growing new brain cells, which I still am not over. I mean, I still, it takes my breath away from the old school where I came, that we didn't believe that could happen. So, there are many things, not the least of which, and perhaps certainly towards the top of the list, would be the very important role that our gut bacteria are playing in affecting the set point of inflammation in the human body. They do so in that they are in charge of maintaining the gut lining, where we want to have a gut lining that is patent or intact or has integrity. When dietary issues, food issues, toxic issues, etc., threaten the integrity of our gut lining, we enhance, through some mechanisms that we may or may not have time to talk about, we enhance inflammation in the body. Why is that a big deal? It's a big deal because we correlate higher levels of things that we measure that relate to inflammation with just about every chronic bad thing that you don't want to have, whether it's coronary artery disease or it's Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. Yes, the truth of the matter is, there are higher markers of inflammatory mediators in the bodies of autistic individuals. Certainly, diabetes is inflammatory, and even cancer. So our main mission here is to keep inflammation at bay. And that is what happens when we are good to our gut bacteria. And I think it's really interesting to consider a study that was published in the highly respected journal Neurology back in 2017. That is the journal that's put out by the board that says you're a board certified neurologist. It's really the go-to neurology journal. And it was an interesting study that looked at 1,600 individuals and evaluated these people many years ago in their 30s and in their 40s and did some blood work on them, measuring markers of inflammation. And these were inflammatory markers back then, which we don't really use these days, but fibrinogen count, von Willebrand's factor, if anybody's interested, total white blood cell count. We use different ones today, C-reactive protein, TNF-alpha, but anyway.
By the way, those are in the Bulletproof Diet. Those are in Headstrong. Those are the core lab tests for inflammation, because it doesn't matter where you're getting the inflammation. If you got it, you got to fix it, and then you start solving it.
You bet.
So anyway, thanks for repeating those. Sure. I'd love to hear those in every show.
But here is what this amazing study revealed. So they look at this group of 1,600 people in their 30s and their 40s, and they follow them for 24 years, this ongoing study. You know, the researchers dedicated and probably passed the torch a couple times. 24 years later, there is a perfect correlation between the level 24 years ago of these inflammatory markers and decline in brain volume and even episodic memory today. In other words, they look at a group of people 24 years ago, those who had the highest level, these inflammatory markers in their 30s, in their 40s, today have the worst memory and shrunken brains. The point is, A, it really correlates the importance of inflammation as a mechanism, but B, it also reinforces the notion that we've got to pay attention to these recommendations and ideas long before we are threatened or seemingly threatened by them. You know, as a neurologist, I deal with people who begin to have memory issues in their 60, their 70, and in their 80s. And by then, you know, this is a process that's been going on for 3 or 4 decades. So the message here, the take-home message, and in fact, I did talk about this at the World Bank, is that we've got to target younger and younger audiences in terms of the long-term message to keep your brain healthy. Alzheimer's is a dialogue that happens between doctors and individuals once it started raining. And John Kennedy, why I use the metaphor, is he told us in his inaugural address that the time to fix the roof is when the sun is shining. So now that makes sense. So I'm not going to say it's in your 30s and 40s you need to start paying attention to this. I'm going to say it's in your adolescence when we're now seeing massive increases in type 2 diabetes and obesity and overweight. I'm going to say it's in childhood. I'm even going to go even a step further, saying that it is during pregnancy that choices a mother makes will have outcome markers in terms of that adult. How do I come to say that? I will say that based upon our understanding, for example, that women taking certain medications like proton pump inhibitors and antibiotics have a significantly increased risk of having a child who will then go on to develop issues related to immune function like type 1 diabetes and even obesity. Therefore, what mother does during pregnancy has a role to play in the risk of her son or daughter ultimately developing Alzheimer's disease. And
it's real.
I know, we're now learning.
I just love it that you said that. My very first book was What Do You Do Before and During Pregnancy to Have the Healthiest, Smartest Child Possible, because that's exactly it. What even your grandmother ate has a huge impact. So this is multi-generational. But I wanted to ask you a question there. If you're listening to this and you're saying, well, you know, I'm 20 and I'm inflamed right now, and 24 years later, I'm going to have a high risk of all this stuff. It appears we can either fully or almost fully mitigate the problems of having inflammation when you're young, as long as you undo the inflammation, because that's been my own experience. My hippocampal volume is in the 86th, 87th percentile for people my age. So my brain didn't shrink, even though I was 300 pounds and screwed up and ate all the wrong stuff and had inflammation everywhere you can probably have inflammation. And I keep it under control really dramatically, and my brain works better now than it did in my 20s. But do you think I'm still going to pay the cost of, we'll say, those years of hard living for the first quarter century of my life?
Well, I think that there is a debt, and I think that you've probably paid the debt back and then some. So I think you've put money back in the bank based upon the things that I know you're doing now. So I think you've undone the damage and you're ahead of the game. You've demonstrated that through your voxel imagery of your hippocampus, as you just mentioned. But those people who do not do the work have great risk. And I'll give you another.
There you go.
So I hope you feel better.
Well, I want people listening, but you can start, you can change it. And I was the worst example, I think, of what you could get because of the prediabetes, the high risk of stroke and heart attack, the high inflammation markers across a whole bunch of different things. Pretty much everything bad on the list of aging other than maybe cancer. I didn't have Alzheimer's, but I had cognitive dysfunction. But just a really, really not an autoimmune stuff. So if I can get to where I am, you probably weren't as far down the hole as I was. So it should take you less work than it did me. But if you do the work, you can get yourself to where you're actually younger than you were before, which is kind of cool.
Well, I mean, you just came back from an anti-aging conference, and that's exactly what we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
And we are talking about reversing this stuff, reversing these declines, which with reference to the brain, we never were schooled in. We never thought the brain had a second chance. And that was the fundamental premise of Grain Brain, that you do get a second chance through this gift of neurogenesis and neuroplasticity. And we spent so much time in the book talking about what you can do to enhance that process. But, you know, you mentioned years ago that you had a lot of extra body fat. And I think it's very instructive to talk about a study that was published way back in 2008, Ancient History, again in the journal Neurology, where they looked at a group of individuals, and this was a much larger, it was 83 individuals. And similarly, they looked at these people at the beginning of the study and then said, check you later. We're going to see you in many years. They actually checked back with these people 34 years later. And 34, 36 years later. The only study they did at the beginning of the research was they measured their sagittal abdominal diameter. Basically, how big is your belly, right? They took a group of individuals, close to 7,000 people. How big is your belly? Check you later. They checked back with these people 36 years later, and they found a perfect correlation between the size of your belly 3+ decades ago and risk for dementia. In comparing those who had the largest sagittal abdominal diameter, biggest belly, versus those who had the smallest diameter, the risk for dementia was increased threefold. A threefold increased risk of dementia simply related to making the choice to having a bigger belly. It is not a cosmetic issue anymore that you got a big belly. And yet we tend in media to be normalizing this notion that being fat is okay. You know what? If you don't care what you look like, that's not what we're talking about. I'm going to ask you, do you care if you're at risk for dementia in 30 years? And maybe people don't care about that because they're placing their hope on the idea that there's a wonderful treatment for Alzheimer's. And I would tell you that there is no such treatment. There is zero treatment for Alzheimer's. There is no drug, Dave Asprey, as you and I have this conversation right now, that has any meaningful effect on that disease. And I want to take this a little bit further. Last month, the Journal of the American Medical Association published a meta-analysis, meaning a review of other studies, by a researcher by the name of Richard Kennedy. And his research looked at probably the best 10 studies that looked at the two major classes of so-called Alzheimer's drugs, the cholinesterase inhibitors, drugs like Aricept, and another drug called memantine, marketed as the drug Namenda. And what he found was, not only do these drugs not work, but as published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, those people taking these Alzheimer's drugs actually declined much more quickly in terms of their cognitive function. I want to tell you right now, I can barely talk about that with you, because think about the literally millions. There are 5.4 million Alzheimer's patients in America. The millions of these individuals who are taking these drugs and whose families put their faith in these drugs because their doctor wrote the prescription, and these drugs are actually making them worse, it'd be like giving somebody a blood pressure pill that raises their blood pressure, or a treatment of diabetes where your blood sugar goes up.
And or a diet soda that makes you obese.
Well, that
seems like a business model that works.
Yeah, but why
it's evil.
Was this not on the front page of the New York Times? Or why didn't NBC News, CBS, ABC cover this, CNN? This was published and put out by the American Medical Association that the very drugs that are being given to these people, when I say given, they're being sold to these people. Financially, it's an issue, and the heartbreak from my perspective, having lost my father to Alzheimer's, so I know what it's like. But the notion that these people put their faith in their doctors and in the pharmaceutical industry, and the very drug that they're taking is causing mom, dad, husband, or wife to actually decline more quickly. We have to, you know, that's important news. So go to drperlmutter.com, read the blog I wrote about it, and the full PDF is available there in the science section, the learn section on my website.
You said something profound in your new book, you know, The New Grain Brain, that's actually got the same title, but it's a very different book than your first version. And you said 90% of literature peer-reviewed journals ever published about the human microbiome have been in the last 5 years. And that's since you published your last book.
Yeah.
So in addition to talking about Alzheimer's and inflammation, what, I mean, this is incredible. And I mean, my really big diet book was 2014. So that's 4 years ago. So that's 80% of this 5 year period. And so all of this new gut bacteria comes out. I read a lot of literature, probably not as much as you because you just read a book about it. But what really stood out as what's different now than when you first wrote the first edition of Grain Brain?
Well, it's a very good question. I think that so many people have been so hard at it in terms of the research. You know, we have some wonderful leaders in the field. Dr. Rob Knight at UCSD, for example, just putting out so much research that ties in the actions of these gut bacteria with some really fundamental processes that underlie whether we live or die. Whether we get cancer or not, whether we develop inflammation or autoimmune conditions or not. So I think in so many areas of medicine where we've been stymied with lack of opportunities to really be impactful, we're now learning that we have a brand new playing field that can be leveraged to give us wonderful, new, empowering opportunities. And it is just beyond exciting to watch the literature every day. There's a wonderful online journal called Cell Host and Microbe, actually, that is available in print copy if you choose, that, you know, on a weekly basis is just giving you these wonderful new studies that are just incredible aha moments for those of us in the field. And for me, I like to portray it as that these new studies are connecting dots for me. I mean, we got a lot of dots that have been connected, but you know, there's a couple of funny pieces to the jigsaw puzzle that we haven't really found yet. But when you find that piece and you drop it in and it fits, oh my gosh, it really adds to continuity. You can start to see the whole picture. Let me give you an example. There's a researcher at the University of Louisville. His name is Yun Teng. And Yun Teng, again, in this journal, Cell Host and Microbe, recently published an article. It came out actually when I was in Switzerland lecturing on this exact topic a couple of months ago, and he noted or discovered that plant cells that contain their own genetic material, RNA, when we eat plants, mm-hmm. that encapsulations of their RNA called microsomes or exosomes, once they leave the cell and are through digestion, that these exosomes of this genetic material travel in the gut, bind to the cell membranes of our gut bacteria, insert themselves into the gut bacteria, and make their way to the genetic material of our gut bacteria, and then influence the genetic expression of the gut bacteria's genome. causing at least three things to happen. Number one, changes in the reproductive activity of that particular species of bacteria, number one. Number two, changing the metabolic products that that gut bacteria might make. And number three, actually changing the location of these gut bacteria, which is important when, as mentioned earlier, we need some of our good gut bacteria to cluster around, especially the clostridial species, to make their way towards the gut lining where they can be at work helping us maintain the integrity of that gut lining. But how incredible that we now understand that plants, yeah, we get prebiotic fiber and that's good for our gut bacteria, but no, we are influencing the genetic expression of the gut bacteria. And make no mistake about it, that connects to another dot that's really important. And that is the dot that we've already understood, whereby the genetic expression of our gut bacteria influences our DNA, our genome. So this now connects the plants that we eat to the expression of our DNA. Wow, those are two very important dots that are now connected. And I think that, as I say, what a very important piece of the jigsaw puzzle has now been put in place. Beyond that, stay with me and think about the notion then, if the RNA, the genetics of the plants that we eat is so important, influential through the mechanism I just described, what then should our level of concern be as it relates to the notion of genetically modifying the plants that we eat? So, people have said, well, there's no real evidence that genetically modified food is creating a health issue for us, and plus, it's going to allow us to feed the planet, whereas otherwise the planet would starve. We can challenge that one on multiple fronts, that notion. But that said, now that we understand that the genetic material of the plant does, in fact, influence the genetic expression of our gut bacteria that plays a role in our DNA expression, then you bet it's time to take pause as it relates to modifying the genome of plants that we eat and look at it through a new lens. And in terms of the doctrine of primum non nocere, above all, do no harm.
Very beautifully put. And there's something else that you came out with in your new version of Grain Brain, a study that I talked about a lot on social media and I believe blogged about last year. And they looked at just about all of the fatty plaque in people who have heart disease. And they found that it doesn't come from egg yolks. It doesn't come from butter. It doesn't come from beef fat. It doesn't even come from bacon. It comes from microbes in your gut. And I actually mentioned this in a friendly discussion with a proponent of the vegan diet. He's saying, you know, meat causes heart disease. And the evidence is in gut bacteria are what's causing heart disease. Because if you eat meat and you have the wrong gut bacteria, they make that TMA stuff we talked about earlier. And even if you don't have that TMA stuff, even if you eat vegetables, if you have plaque in your arteries, it was made by your gut bacteria. Do you believe that's the case? I mean, I believe the study. It looked well done. There's no way to argue with, you know, the isotopes they're looking at in this stuff. But what's your take on that? How real is it?
Well, it's not the end all cause, but I think that again, it really speaks to this notion that the health, vitality of our and diversity, perhaps the most operative word here, of our gut bacteria is massively important in determining our health destiny. And beyond that, we understand that it isn't the quantity of certain fats or fat carriers, the lipoproteins, that is really the issue. Madison Avenue, somebody came up with the notion of calling LDL bad cholesterol, and they get a great prize for that because everybody's latched onto that. I want to get my bad cholesterol, since it's bad, it should be as low as possible. And, well, there must be a good cholesterol. Oh, yes, there is. It's HDL. A, they're not cholesterol. They're proteins. B, they're both really, really good. Yes, LDL is what transports an important fat to your brain called cholesterol that we desperately need. You know, it does a great job. When you compromise LDL, you're in big trouble. We know that LDL, in terms of its how it's modified, how it makes its way through the brain vasculature, for example, the blood vessels within the brain, crossing what we call the blood-brain barrier. When LDL has been damaged, we see great relationships to mechanisms that underlie significant brain degeneration. So let's just first by characterizing LDL as good and HDL as good, and that the issue, and let's relate this back to our gut bacteria for a moment, that becomes important is not the amount of LDL. It's good to have LDL to transport our fats, but it's the state in which we find our LDL. Has it been damaged or has it not been damaged? And what do I mean by that? LDL is damaged in a couple of ways. It can be oxidized, in other words, the action of free radicals. And that certainly is influenced dramatically by the foods we eat and how the foods influence the expression of our gut bacteria. Whether we're on a ketogenic diet, for example, whether we are eating types of vegetables that enhance pathways to increase our antioxidants, like the NRF2 pathway, i.e., why we want to eat broccoli and drink coffee and use turmeric in our cooking, etc. But beyond that, another issue that is so influential in terms of our LDL is, has it been glycated? What does it mean? It means, has it been not just oxidized, but now has it bound itself to sugar? Glycation is a process by which proteins bind to sugar. And once they do so, they are modified and become less functional. The main issue that we need from our LDL, which is not bad cholesterol, we love our LDL. It's keeping us alive. The main issue is what we're looking for is functionality. We will compromise the functionality of our LDL and therefore be in great trouble, like heart disease, like cerebrovascular disease, strokes, etc. We compromise functionality of our LDL, which is not bad cholesterol, when it is either oxidized by the excess activity of production of free radicals in the presence of inadequate antioxidants, or it is glycated. Now, let's just look at, not everybody can go and have their glycated LDL blood test done, but a terrific surrogate marker that anyone can tomorrow go to their doctors and have done that correlates almost perfectly with the level of glycated and even downstream oxidation of LDL is a very simple test. A glycated hemoglobin test. Is that unusual? That's the A1C that they talk about on the diabetes drug commercials that you see on the evening news. Everybody knows about their A1C because, you know, there are 60% of Americans now that are probably have their A1Cs checked because they are pre-diabetic adults, or frankly diabetic. So everyone's familiar with A1C. What does it mean? It means glycation, in this case, sugar binding to a protein called hemoglobin. That's the oxygen carrying, carbon dioxide carrying molecule within our red blood cells. So that is a terrific surrogate marker for this LDL glycation and LDL oxidation or oxidatively damaged by the actions of free radicals.
So the glycated hemoglobin also tells you whether your LDL is oxidized, not just whether your LDL is glycated, because those are different types of damage pathways.
Absolutely. So there's when things are great point. When things are glycated, they oxidize. Two things are triggered by the glycation of proteins: oxidation, higher levels of free radicals, and who knew, inflammation. So these things all come together. Again, it's all about these dots. And when you're pulling the research, writing a book or updating a book, and these things come together, you just say to yourself, why that's fantastic, or hashtag WTF, why that's fantastic. because it really is. And you make these connections. I got to write a book about this. People have to know that lowering inflammation in your body and lowering your blood sugar to reduce glycation of proteins is so very important. One graph that I included in Grain Brain. And now with the new release of the revised edition, I included, because it's so compelling, is the relationship of A1C to brain shrinkage. Higher A1C, higher rate of brain shrinkage. It's linear. You've got to know that. And having an A1C of 6, when your doctor says, oh, you're not diabetic, everything's cool, go home, keep doing what you're doing, that does not jive with the science that's telling us that a hemoglobin A1C of 8.16 is good for you. That's BS. You need your A1C down to 5.2, and that's pretty much take that one to the bank.
Once, how low would you go if you could set it as low as you want it? Like, you know, I don't want to be average. I want to live 180.
I don't know the answer to that, but I will tell you that one thing I've learned over the years is that there is this notion of what we call the U-shaped curve, or perhaps the sweet spot, where too low, or the sin. Goldilocks area, right? Where the porridge was too cold, the porridge was too hot, and this one's just right. So we know that higher A1Cs, for example, are correlated to cognitive decline. But, you know, we've been talking for years about keeping your, not just your blood sugar low, but actually your insulin level low. And I will note that a recent study that came out of Sweden was published just in May of, this is 2018. I know this will be evergreen, but published earlier this year, 2018. The study also published in one of my favorite journals called Neurology, looked at 1,200 women between the ages of mid-30s somewhere up to age 60, followed them for 34 years. And what did they find? That they measured one thing at the beginning of the study, and that was their fasting insulin levels. They found that those individuals with the lowest level of insulin actually had an increased risk of dementia of about 2.3-fold. Those in the middle range of insulin levels, as they defined it by definition of their study, their risk was put at 1. And those in the higher ranges of insulin, as you might expect, also had a higher risk for dementia of 1.7, not as high as the very, very low levels of insulin. And so, you know, the notion of trying to keep your insulin level really, really low, I think we have to temper that. The notion of over-exercising, I think, should be looked at in terms of the U-shaped curve, the sweet spot. The amount of sleep that we get, for example, the amount of nutrients that we take in, the amount of fat we consume, vitamins we can overdo or underdo. So I think that the notion of the more the merrier, and I, for one, have been guilty of that personally, you know, I was told that it'd be good to do something. I always did twice that or more than that. And I know you are the same way. I've been to you're broadcasting or recording this studio. Leave it at that. So you are like me. We both have been aggressive about things. And I think understanding that there is an ideal place. Yeah. You know, so the question then becomes, you know, how do we zone in on that? How do we fine-tune that analog dial on the FM radio to get the very best signal? You turn the dial to the left, you get static. Turn it to the right, get static. You really want to fine-tune. That's what biohacking is all about. That's what understanding biometrics and crunching the data is all about.
What's really frustrating is when you see, well, here's how you score your testosterone compared to the average 46-year-old. Oh. Like, that's one of the laws in Game Changers, is average is the enemy. I don't want to be the average 46-year-old, because most of us are like developing dad bod the way I had in my 20s. And you know, our muscle mass is going up, our testosterone is going down. And like, don't compare me to average. You tell me ideal, but medicine has failed us in telling us what's ideal.
You're right.
So I'm like, well, if this works, let me try doubling that and tripling that, and then try going back and tuning that dial myself. But I feel like even some of these studies that you talk about in Grain Brain over the last 5 years, we're starting to understand enough that maybe we can get these numbers dialed in so I don't have to do the guesswork. So the biohackers listening, and certainly there's a lot of people listening who are not biohackers and don't go out and do all this stuff. They just want to, you know, feel good and perform well. And I think we're sort of failing them by not saying, you know, here's the number. And you did it right here, Dr. Perlmutter. Like, okay. You want to have a number of 5.2. You don't want it to be 6, and you probably don't want it to be 4. But that's based on very recent knowledge versus most of the other lab metrics. When you get it back, what the lab tells you is garbage for the reference range because you don't want to be normal. Normal people die.
Yeah, well, that's in the normal range.
Yeah.
And what is normal these days? Normal is, by definition, average. We, you know, that's how they develop these lab values. You take a large number of people, and then they use one standard deviation on either side of the peak, and they say that's in the normal range. And I think that's a huge disservice to people who want to be optimized. So, yeah, we can talk about a vitamin D level being in the normal range, 30 to 100, and that means that I'm okay at 31. Well, that you are not okay. You're not okay, quite literally, in my book. You're not okay in my book because I want as many people that I can touch over time to be their best, to be not only their best today in terms of their functionality, but to be their best tomorrow in terms of being resistant to the degenerative processes that are so pervasive now in global society. So you have your opportunity to be your best when you begin to understand that you have to be that N of one that challenges the notion of normal range of, you know, the medical model where as only as much as 3% of people ever, data from 3% of people are extrapolated to the remaining 97%, or actually the 100%, because they're then included in that, in terms of the recommendations that are made by mainstream medicine. That is, as my dad used to say, bass ackwards. You know, and it raises this discussion of personalized medicine, where we want to know about Dave Asprey specifically. Not your wife, not your neighbor. We want to know about you. What's your pedigree? What does your microbiome look like? What do your current biometrics look like? And from that, we'll develop a program that is best for you. Now, having said that, and it's in, I gave this talk at Jeff Bland's Personal Lifestyle Medicine Institute conference, I guess it was 2 months ago, that you know, that's the future. That's the best we can do. And we should extrapolate from that information back to the notion of making the broad stroke recommendations. There's great value in the broad stroke recommendations in terms of those, you know, the broader reach of the population that's not going to necessarily be able to participate in a very in-depth personalized medicine approach. And those broad stroke recommendations are that you've got to cut down on your simple carbohydrates. You've got to understand what is the notion of net carbohydrates. And by all means, as we talked about at the beginning of this discussion, not eliminate the fiber, by definition, a complex carbohydrate from your diet. That dietary fat, if you're careful about what that fat is in terms of its type, is fundamental to your health. Understand the discussion, Dave, that you and I had earlier with reference to meat and its quality. And beyond that, look at the things like sleep and the restorative nature of sleep and exercise, for example, as broad stroke recommendations that we really need to engage. The main premise of Grain Brain, and now with the revision, has always been to appeal to the larger audience. Yes, we made a few specific recommendations in terms of fasting insulin, a vitamin D level, a hemoglobin A1C, fasting blood sugar, amount of exercise to get, looking at your sleep, getting a sleep study, as it were, as one type of intervention of study to understand you know, who you are and what your risks are. But by and large, it's the broad strokes that I believe everyone can do. And, you know, one of the recommendations I make in the book, and again with the revision that's coming out next week, and that is you do have to buy something. I am wanting you to buy something, and here's the pitch. Here's what you got to buy. Oh, and people are saying, oh, I knew that was coming. Yes, you need to go out and buy a new pair of sneakers. That's it. I mean, if you have to do one thing and buy one thing, go out and get a new pair of sneakers. It's so undervalued that our sedentarity is killing us. And you know, people think, oh, I've just got to get the project finished. I've got to, whatever it is. And, you know, by and large, our work is done by sitting. and in front of the computer. You and I are doing it right now. This is the only time of day that I'm going to really be doing this. And I've already had my aerobic workout for the day and going to do another one in just a bit. But that said, that's a huge issue. And again, it's something that everybody can do. For me, I would say, even if it's walking to the mailbox and coming back, that's a start if you didn't do that before. If you're in a wheelchair, you buy some free weights and you do something. But I think everyone should be really cognizant of the fact that aerobic exercise, and now we know resistance exercise as well, is a powerful way to change the expression of your life code, of your DNA, for the better. And who wouldn't want to do that?
You talk about something else in the new Grain Brain that wasn't a big focus in the old one. You talk about ketosis. And we've also talked about these Goldilocks zones. And at the beginning of this, you said what I think is going to be the title of the show, why you desperately need carbohydrates. Because like, what? Well, you do. It's called...
Great idea. You should definitely do that with Dr. David Perlmutter. People are going to really say why that's fantastic, WTF. Go ahead.
Totally. I mean, you're going to have to listen to the show and realize that you're actually correct. Like, if you don't have anything to feed your gut bacteria, you're wrong. But there's definitely people... It'll cause a double take for sure. But... And there's an ideal number for that stuff. And clearly you and I are not going to be in the camp of high carbs ever. But also the zero carb is maybe going too far. With ketosis, I see some of the sort of fans of, as long as it's not a carb, I'll eat it type of ketosis, saying, oh, you know, my blood levels are 2, 3, 4, you know, my ketones are higher than yours. I took these non-bioidentical exogenous ketones and, you know, look what happened. And, I have a belief based on the studies I've seen and all about a good number of ketones for people. But I want to know what you think after writing the new Grain Brain, because you've put a lot more focus on keto, because you're a neurologist. Because now, 5 years after you wrote the first one, we know way more about ketones in the brain. You know there's something going on. What's the number that people, what's the max, what's the min, what's the average, where should we be?
Well, again, you know, we want to try to find that Goldilocks zone. Yeah. And I think it has to be contextual. I think we have to look at not just ketones, and we'll get there in just a moment, but in the context of also your fasting blood sugar. So again, we want our fasting blood sugar, as I've said before, in the 70s, in the 80s. I'm lower than that, but I'm okay with it. These are just, you know, general recommendations. And I'd like to see people getting their beta-hydroxybutyrate as a specific ketone that is measured, which does require a finger prick, to be at least 0.5, 0.7, 0.8 in that range.
Hallelujah. I was going to say 0.5 to 0.8. That's all the numbers I've seen. Okay. It is not 1. It is not 3. It is not 5. You might want to spike it for something, but having it high all the time is bad. And okay, why those ranges? I know there's two studies I love, but you probably have more.
Well, I think that that's a heck of a lot of beta-hydroxybutyrate floating around, doing what it needs to do. And to be clear, the research demonstrates a absolute linear correlation between brain levels of beta-hydroxybutyrate emulating what we find in the blood. And research would demonstrate that these levels of beta-hydroxybutyrate in the brain are actually very active. And, you know, this is, some of the research that Dr. Bredesen has leveraged in terms of his recommendations, which fall into the same range as you and I just quoted, allowing people actually the ability to recover from Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, I take a big push from that. I also think that, it is achievable by the common man, that it is, you know, it certainly may be enhanced by adding MCT oil or coconut oil to the regimen. But I think even with a fairly well-defined ketogenic diet, to get that level most of the time is a good thing. I also believe that the hormesis or the stress metabolically that is imparted by a little bit lower blood sugar from time to time, and therefore a slightly higher 1 to 1.5 range of beta-hydroxybutyrate, has got to have some downstream positive effects when you stress the body that way, mimicking fasting. That brings up another idea of fasting mimicking, but mimicking caloric scarcity. And I think the body goes into a really protective mode. There's no food. We've got to start changing what genes are expressing and what genes are not expressing, because we don't have access to a caloric resource here. At the same time, I would indicate that having a higher blood sugar from time to time, not higher than normal, but just letting it come up a little bit. And so cycling through this looks like, based upon really fairly recent research, to be more in line with mimicking our Paleolithic environment, and also allowing genes to be more adept at expressing themselves. But again, I think that you bring to mind these, you know, if it's, as long as it's not a carb, I'm going to eat it. You can absolutely have a very detrimental effect on your ability to get into ketosis and lower your blood sugar if you're eating lots and lots of meat, for example, or just protein in general. And I think that's such an important concept through the notion that high levels of amino acids, the breakdown products of protein, can be reassembled through a process in the liver called glucose sugar, new genesis, making new sugar, is enhanced in that scenario where you're eating. You go ahead and say, if it's meat, I'm going to eat it. And, you know, basically, again, Atkins redux, apart from the this mTOR consideration, where you're activating a pathway that really is profoundly detrimental, leading to cellular death, pre-programmed death, and leading to mitochondrial failure. So, you know, maybe what we're saying seems complicated, but again, I think that people should, you know, based on current data, and let's be clear, you know, we may, you and I may get together 5 years from now and say, we learn through current research that the world is flat. And we're going to say, here, we were wrong. World, it wasn't round, it's flat. I guess I could be open to that. It'd be a stretch. But what we understand now, and it's, again, it's bolstered, as I mentioned, by 2 million years of being tested on the racetrack, that you know, a diet that doesn't have simple carbohydrates, that has lots of carbs, Perlmutter's saying, eat a lot of carbs, the title of this podcast. But these are carbs that are fiber, that are nurturing your gut bacteria, that isn't eating meat and eggs and cheese and milk products all day. No, that's not what we're saying. Mostly plant-based, but not entirely, if that is your
and
choice.
And plant-based does not mean eating basically flour all the time, grains, only beans, rice, starch, right? So we're almost like mostly plants, but not plant babies. I don't know exactly how to express that to people. You're talking about green vegetables when you say mostly plants, not so much, you know, potatoes that are also plants.
That's right. And we say basically above ground vegetables, above ground, because these are vegetables that by and large, aside from their seeds that we'll get to in a moment, by and large don't store carbohydrate in the form of starch. So having a couple of potato, not potatoes, but, you know, a few pieces of potato or carrot, which does grow under the ground, turnips, whatever, they're not unreasonable. But, you know, we certainly want to avoid the seeds of grass because the products derived therefrom are generally going to spike your blood sugar. And if it's wheat, barley, or rye, and now even oats, of course, you're going to get exposed to gluten and specifically part of it called gliadin. And, you know, we really spoke about in Grain Brain 5 years ago, the work of a British researcher, Marius Hadjivassiliou, who I think was really the pioneer in terms of the notion that gluten can have extra intestinal effects, meaning effects outside of the digestive system. What a notion. So he was even very clear that neurological conditions, issues, manifestations can occur in response to being sensitive to this protein called gluten. And that was, the rejection of his, although he published in the journal Lancet, I might add, but there was a resounding rejection of his his concepts, which I felt were very, very valid. And since that time, as you well know, this notion of non-celiac gluten sensitivity has been absolutely supported globally by literature, to the extent that even the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2017 published a very extensive review with Harvard researchers contributing to this review. In fact, Dr. Alessio Fasano was quoted, was a contributor to this study, absolutely affirming for us the notion of non-celiac gluten sensitivity and the notion that gluten sensitivity can have significant extra-intestinal manifestations that may involve the brain. So when we talked in 5 years ago about movement disorders, about ADHD, other issues with cognition, headache, for example, possibly being related to gluten sensitivity because science supported that, yeah, there was pushback. But now, my goodness, now it's really becoming much more accepted, and I am I'm really grateful to for the degree of validation. When you know, I published a study several years ago with a Dr. Aristo Vajdani, where we demonstrated markers in the blood demonstrating gluten sensitivity without celiac disease in a patient with about 28 years of intractable headaches, having to take opioids to control his pain and going gluten-free and finally coming off opioids after, you know, more than two decades. So,
well, Dr. Perlmutter, this is why your work matters. And for people listening, you don't have notes in front of you. You know these studies because you write books and because you read these so you can be better in the clinic every day. And all the science is real. It's all out there. So if you're still stuck in that, you know, I've got to have my, you know, sticky white bun on my cheeseburger or something, just know it is not free. And the idea that I'm going to spend less on my food as long as it tastes good is not actually spending less, because you're probably going to not like how you feel. So I just have to say thanks. Thanks for the new grain brain. Thanks for your decades of work in the field. It has made a big difference, and I appreciate it. And if you love today's show, you should check out the new Grain Brain. And if you happen to order it on Amazon at the same time you order Game Changers, they'll be stuck together for other people.
Oh, there you go. Forever.
Exactly. thanks again for being on the show. Thanks for being such a great friend and such a big, dare I say, game changer.
Well, I will tell you that I was very, very honored not only to be spoken about in terms of my work in your book, but to be supportive of the book in general, because it's a really a great resource, because, you know, we must learn from others, and you've cultivated an incredible cadre of individuals who absolutely by definition have been game changers and are helping moving the ball down the field, you know, challenging the status quo. Ronald Reagan reminded us, well, didn't remind us, but he told us that the term status quo is Latin for the mess we're in. And so, you know, to make changes and challenge the accepted dogma allows us to make progress. So I appreciate the fact that you do that and everything that you do, because it's really, is it disruptive? Yes. And that's a really, really good thing.
If you liked today's episode, well, I already told you what to do. Go ahead and read something good. You know the good stuff to read. Thanks for listening.
A Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem, or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.